True Confessions. On Wednesday, August 1st, 1973, the LaGrange Chicken Ranch, the oldest continually operating non-floating whorehouse in the United States, was closed down. The Texas Chamber of Commerce elected to ignore the passage of an establishment possibly older than all of its members, and the State Historical Society, equally misfeasant, overlooked the shuttering of the house that slept more politicians than the Driscoll Hotel and the Governor's Mansion combined. You all know about the Chicken Ranch, of course. It was just about the first tourist attraction I heard about when I came to Texas. But then I came to Texas to be an Aggie, so that explains that. Later on, I even learned that there was a town called LaGrange, nestled somewhere on the outskirts of the whorehouse of the same name. Hell, I even went to LaGrange once. The whorehouse, I mean. Not, mind you, because I had any truly unquenchable perversions that required a trip to LaGrange to unleash, but rather because I figured that if one was going to be an Aggie, well, then be an Aggie. The pilgrimage to LaGrange sits close to the heart of the Aggie myth, as central as the catechism of standing at football games and building the bonfire for the Texas game. We went on Thursday night when they had the $8 Aggie special. Trekking down in an old Pontiac full of fraudulently purchased Lone Star and a thousand obscene variants of some drastically original horny Aggie fantasy. We circled around town for a while, body temperature rising in inverse proportion to the declining stash of Lone Star and the increasingly depravity of the fantasy, a deep, twisted well of prurient anxiety, gradually filling to the point where no adolescent squeamishes could possibly abort an explosive gusher of sinful lust. How's that for metaphor, eh? Us Aggies get a three-syllable handicap in this magazine writin'. In any case, the air went out of the fantasy as soon as we pulled into the Chicken Ranch parking lot, and the first person we spotted was a deputy sheriff. He was just there to help park cars, though, so we proceeded on up to the door where Lily, the black maid, the only black as a matter of strict fact, historical accuracy being an important part of articles like this, whoever passed the doors of the Chicken Ranch, checked our phony IDs to make sure we were 21 and let us in. We sauntered into the parlor where we drunkenly introduced ourselves to a half dozen local farmers, a couple of cross-country truck drivers, and a fellow pilgrim who had journeyed all the way down from Nebraska and met three young ladies who either worked there or were truck drivers too. We weren't sure which. One of the young ladies offered to sell us Coke for 50 cents, which we declined, and then one of her friends asked us for a quarter to play the jukebox, which we cheerfully provided. My friend Richard, who was still trying to decide if they worked there or were just visiting truck drivers, thought he'd break the ice a little by asking one of them if she wanted to dance, which she didn't. "What's with this dancing stuff, honey?" is what she said. "Y'all want to do some business here or not?" That's when we decided she must be one of the UT co-eds we had heard about. Pretty soon after that, I picked one of the ladies, or she picked me, quite possibly, my recollection being sort of hazy, and we wandered off down the hall to one of the bedrooms. The walls of the room possessed an angularity that was bespoke distracted carpentry, all of them covered with irregular splotches of pastel paint, and the furnishings consisted of a bed, a dresser, and a sink, all rather commonplace in appearance and not at all meeting my expectations. The top dresser drawer had been left open to reveal an intriguing assortment of oils, photographs, and leather goods, but I held firm for the Aggie special, which didn't include any of its contents. Ruthie, who was the lady I'd picked, or who had picked me, just rolled her eyes and made a face when I told her I only had the $8 anyway. She told me to get your clothes off, honey, and left to go deposit my money someplace. I thought for a bit about how this wasn't the way we had planned it on the way down and was consequently a little slow getting undressed, being still garbed in my pants when Ruthie got back. "What's this?" she asked me. "We ain't got all night, you know." I apologized for being so slow and took my pants off. She then started poking and tugging at me. "Checking for diseases," she said, a bit of foreplay that possessed all the sensuality of my army physical. Ruthie next threw me down on the bed and took off her own clothes and lay down beside me, and told me that for just $8, I didn't get to kiss her. Pleased that I hadn't brought any more money, we just started pawing and pulling at each other. Next thing I knew, she was on top of me and asking if I was finished already, honey. I said. Then she pulled me up off the bed, washed us both off, and told me to get your clothes back on, honey. It had been what's known in the trade as a forget. Get up, get on, get off, and get out. I met the rest of my cohorts outside, all except for Richard, whom we had to wait another hour and a half. He had been abased at being turned down for his dance, that he had gone and splurged $40 on a lavish degeneracy of sufficient novelty that its graphic description entertained us all the way back to College Station. A Sentimental History of America's Oldest Whorehouse. When old Frank Lotto published the first History of Fayette County back in 1902, he wrote with what must have been a sly snicker to himself that the city of LaGrange has made a reputation for sociability over the whole state. It was nicely located for friendly ambiance, being sprawled around high limestone bluffs on a parabolic stretch of the Colorado River in that part of central Texas where the coastal plains begin gently ballooning into a sinuous undulation that goes off westering to the hill country. Dense battalions of age-disfigured live oaks, camouflaged in clouds of hanging moss and sentried by towering cedars, occupy the creek and river bottoms, while post oak columns skirt the soft green edges of Bermuda grass hillsides and cypress files demarcate the boundaries of old Spanish land grants. The Second Congress of the Republic of Texas, enticed by vistas that but few countries on earth can compare with, overwhelmingly voted to establish their permanent capital at LaGrange, and only President Sam Houston's self-serving veto kept it in the still unbuilt Jerkwater Burg named for himself. If the easy rolling richness of Fayette County posed no strong attraction for General Sam, it proved a powerful lure across the world in Central Europe. Beginning in the 1830s, it became the terminus for South Germans and Bohemians in flight from famine and persecution. They brought with them an industrious capacity for small farming, which still endures, and an independence of mind bordering on the perverse, which also still endures. Even after 1860, when they voted not to secede with the rest of the state, Fayette County has maintained a strong tradition of political abhorrence. The immigrants also imported a zesty beer hall enthusiasm for rowdy pleasures. Indeed, nothing in the county's history has proven so consistently unpopular as temperance, which went down to its first massive electoral defeat in 1877. It was the kind of indulgent tolerance that could sanction the longest-running brothel ever to open its doors and beds in America. Just when exactly those doors and beds did open is a point of some contention. Dates offered range all the way from 1844, based largely on myth, to 1915, when the house was installed in its present location on the outskirts of town. The most likely occasion for its founding is somewhere in between, with several LaGrange old-timers remembering its definite existence prior to the turn of the century. Ernest Emmerich, who was town marshal in neighboring Round Rock back around the First World War, remembers then-county sheriff August Loyson telling him it was there when August took office in 1894. The debate, in any case, is spuriously academic. Just as a history of North America, despite its prior existence, doesn't really commence until Columbus, so the true story of the chicken ranch doesn't begin until the arrival, in about 1905 of Ms. Fay Stewart, alias Jesse Williams, and known to friends, employees, and numerous intimate acquaintances and elusive posterity as Miss Jesse. Originally from Hubbard, up near Waco, Miss Jesse was a whorehouse madam on an epic scale, prostitution's answer to Casey Stengel or Vince Lombardi, author and actor, is one of the great chapters in the journal of her profession. A woman of undeniable personal resonance with rough-hewn country charm and shrewd backwoods tenacity, she is still discussed with soft-eyed affection and reverential tones by those who knew her. Buddy Zapalek, the editor of the LaGrange Journal, says, "She just had to be one of the most amazing women who ever lived. She was strong, but she was generous too. And hoo boy, but she was a smart one." It was Miss Jesse who somehow brought discipline and profit to the house while making peace with the surrounding community at large and its power center in particular. She also negotiated the tacit treaties that enabled her house to survive in the face of contradiction and indignation, a diplomatic performance rivaling those of Henry Kissinger. Among the first allies she acquired were the Loyson brothers, August and Will, the former being county sheriff and the latter, younger, being at once the city marshal in LaGrange and his brother's chief deputy and later his successor as sheriff. Widely venerated as peace officers, the brothers Loyson seem genuinely to have been well-respected and able peacekeepers, August being the only Central Texas sheriff to crush the Ku Klux Klan during its bloody pre-war resurgence, and Will earning a statewide reputation for ingenious detective work. The early basis for their pact with Miss Jesse seems to have been kind of a mutual coexistence. She forswore many of those sidelines that would seem natural in a country cat house. Liquor, most notably, and operated it as peaceably and businesslike as the post office. The two sheriffs, for their part, just ignored it. It was a beneficial relationship. Miss Jesse prospered, and in 1915, she abandoned the battered downtown hotel they then occupied and moved her business to the southeastern outskirts of town. She brought in a few new girls as well, including two sisters who learned their craft in the break hell East Texas oil boom and were able to serve as middle management. The house was by now rooting itself into the communal fabric of LaGrange and its resident employees, encouraged by Miss Jesse to stay on a permanent basis, had fashioned a broad array of links with the townsfolk. When the boys from LaGrange went overseas to save democracy in the Great War, the girls from the ranch sent them cookies. Soon after the end of the war, Will Loyson was elected to succeed his brother. At some nebulous earlier point, he had made a discovery that struck a glorious chord in his detective heart, one that would repercuss down through all the following years of Fayette County law enforcement. This was, in essence, that men, significantly including local lawbreakers, are 1. Habitually prone to bursts of braggadocio, often self-incriminating and helpfully revealing when they are in bed with women. And 2, these same men were regularly inclined to go to bed with women out at Miss Jesse's. Wonder of wonders, Will Loyson, in one of the grandest strokes in the annals of detectivery, had buried deep in the twisted solar plexus of the criminal element an incredibly organic wiretap. And Miss Jesse, not disinterested in further cementing her alliance with the forces of justice, was graciously amenable to stepped-up cooperation. From thenceforward, continuing on through all of his 26 years as county sheriff, Will Loyson would journey nightly out to the edge of town to visit with Miss Jesse and learn what intelligence may have been ferreted out of these subtle pack of eavesdroppers. The ranch itself was undergoing a little facelift about this time. Not only had Miss Jesse added on a couple of rooms to accommodate her burgeoning flock, but the gilded age of post-war ebullience was sending liberating vibrations even unto the outskirts of LaGrange. the girls acquired shiny new cars and flapperish regalia. The rooms received new paint and overstuffed furniture. Frenetic snatches of jazz were caught drifting through the woods, and Miss Jessie's unrepentious county whorehouse almost became a body-citified sporting house as it passed through the gaudiest phase of its lifetime. The emancipation of the ranch, though, did not include any creatively expanded repertoire of available pleasures. Waco bred Miss Jessie had always looked with fundamental distaste on all possible erotic combinations that went beyond the duly conventional missionary position, and the contentionally whetted appetites of war-returned farm boys made her furious. One LaGrange old-timer, a thrice-weekly regular back in those days, remembers trying to explain to a girl named Deaf, Eddie, how to navigate one pleasantly intricate movement. "So we called her Deaf Eddie, 'cause she really was hard of hearing. So I was having a talk pretty loud. Well, what happened is that Miss Jessie heard me and came crashing into there, hitting me with a big iron rod and hollering about turning her girls into French whores. She throwed me out and wouldn't have let me back for a month." Prices at Miss Jessie's then were on an easily computed sliding scale based solely on the time consumed, climbing from $3 up to about a $40 maximum, and not until years later did other variables serve to complicate the equation. The only disruption of these simple accounting procedures came with the Great Depression, when rural economies collapsed into a chaos of barter and salvage. Miss Jessie, whose depression-sparked social consciousness would make her one of the fiercest new dealers in the country, promptly adjusted to the new market by accepting payment in farm produce at the straightforward rate of one chicken, one screw. The backyard was quickly overrun with scratching and fluttering Dominickers and Rhode Island Reds, and the heretofore anonymous whorehouse became the Chicken Ranch. Thus christened, the ranch passed quietly through the rest of the decade, the only disruptions caused by a rare and foolish Republican who had the temerity to challenge Miss Jessie's estimation of Franklin Roosevelt. The ranch was by then thoroughly embedded into the webwork of life in Fayette County. Miss Jessie contributed money to local civic clubs and church bazaars, establishing the policy of municipal philanthropy that in later years would see the ranch become the largest sponsor of the Little League. And while stopping short of joining the JCs, Miss Jessie manipulated capital expenditures in a way that best suited everyone, not excluding herself. Deliveries from groceries, hardware stores, dairies, five and dimes, all were rotated on a weekly basis so that each would receive their share of the ranch's business. Early in his tenure, Will Loyson had begun the tradition, which continued on up to this year, of reporting on conditions at the ranch to the twice-annual Fayette County Grand Jury. Estimates of revenue, reports on fights or arrests, or information learned were all provided, and an occasionally rambunctious grand jury would troop on out to see for themselves, Miss Jessie pleasantly showing them around. In later years, girls going to work at the ranch would stop first at the sheriff's office to be mugged and fingerprinted so that checks could be run to see if they'd ever done something illegal somewhere. One of those early grand juries began the practice of requiring weekly medical exams for the girls at Miss Jessie's, and the Office of County Medical Examiner was created solely for that purpose. In more modern times, after the office was abolished, the girls would appear every Thursday at the LaGrange Health Clinic to have their non-contaminatory status officially certified. When America found itself in another war in 1941 and a second generation of Fayette County farm boys left to participate, the girls at Miss Jessie's again sent cookies in wrapped bandages for the Red Cross. The Army moved in a training center at nearby Bastrop, and apparently concerned that indiscriminate whoring might short-circuit the American soldiers' innate killer instincts, launched a wide-ranging campaign against prostitution. Life at the ranch temporarily became a little more circumspect, but the officially subversive operations went unimpaired for the duration. The end of the war brought, amidst other happenings, the retirement of Will Loyson. His replacement, ascending almost mechanically into the vacancy, was T.J. Jim Flournoy, who had been Will's chief deputy for a dozen years before putting in as a stint as a Texas Ranger. In the same inevitable manner that a national administration will assume the accumulated allies and obligations of all its predecessors, Jim Flournoy inherited all those instinctive understandings and tacit pacts that Miss Jessie had forged 40 years earlier with the Loyson brothers. The momentum of the ranch swept past another milepost without a missed step or side glance. Some of that feisty energy that had driven her thus far had begun to subside, though, and while post-war prosperity was acknowledged in the form of a couple more tacked-on bedrooms, the attendant post-war exuberance inspired no response at the ranch. They just settled a few years earlier into that semi-moribund inertia that captured the country through most of the 50s. Miss Jessie, wheelchair-bound in her last years, watched the decade turn from the front porch of the chicken ranch, still firmly in command and still admitting respect for no one since Franklin Roosevelt. She died, Faye Stewart died, in 1961, mourned by many who were too embarrassed to demonstrate it and missed by four generations of men whose passage from innocence she had administered. She had, moreover, wrought permanent change in the world she occupied. Her ranch, at some ephemeral point in its passage through the years, had transcended its role as merely a whorehouse to become an institution, as important a work in the gallery of Texana as Spindletop or San Jacinto. The whorehouse at LaGrange had passed mouth to ear through the locker room memories of four generations of Texas men, and its widespread acceptance was tacit acknowledgement of its new status. The Texas legislature made reference to it in lighthearted floor debate as early as the 40s, and Miss Jessie returned the compliment by amending her cash-only policy to include the acceptance of state payroll checks. Books, magazines, and newspapers all wrote sympathetically of its existence, and as the 60s appeared, adventuresome students would make it a topic for term papers and master's theses. Indeed, if the chicken ranch is viewed strictly as an illegal brothel, then the largest part of the state of Texas was for 20 years involved in a cover-up of unmatched proportions. More likely, the ranch had passed beyond the ranch of the law into another, more sentimental dimension, where the law serves no purpose. Miss Jessie was to be succeeded by a woman as thoroughly schooled for her role as Jim Flournoy had been for his. Edna Milton had come to work at the ranch in 1952, and by the time Miss Jessie died, was chief lieutenant in the management of the house. Red-haired and tough-skinned, with clear green laser-piercing eyes, Edna evokes an authoritative confidence that could as easily run a Teamsters local as a whorehouse. She arranged to purchase the ranch from Faye Stewart's estate and installed herself as madam, moving into the master bedroom that still contained Miss Jessie's massive four-poster walnut bed. To all appearances, the house absorbed the shift in management as effortlessly as it had the paper altercation of ownership, the only real changes being the installation of air conditioning and the offering of a limited variety of exotic extras. Edna, even before Miss Jessie died, had been in charge when the ranch weathered its greatest crisis. Texas Attorney General Will Wilson, who wanted to be a U.S. Senator, had sounded the call for a great moral crusade aimed vaguely at making the state safe for the easily outraged, who presumably form an impressive block of voters. State law enforcement officials were dashing hungrily around on the hot trail of sin, very nearly arresting the entire island of Galveston, and it seemed likely that the chicken ranch, as the state's most notoriously renowned whorehouse, would be a sure target. Edna's response was to go underground, making the pretense of shutting down while admitting regular customers through the back door. It was good enough. Like all crusades, Wilson's choked on the heat of its own righteousness, and he soon went away. The ranch slipped back into a normal high gear and went humming along into its future, sweetly indifferent to muffled indignation or pious politicians, prepared to cope when necessary with the inevitable next crusade. The next crusader, though, would come armed with cameras. The electric bounty hunter meets the nightmare sheriff. Marvin Zindler was a public curiosity, even before he became a nightly refutation of McLuhan's thesis that television is the province of the cool. Marvin is most assuredly not cool, and never has been. Back when he was heading the Consumer Protection Division of the Harris County Sheriff's Department, he would inveigh against truthless advertisers or fast-dealing car salesmen with all the indignant wrath of a Calvinist preacher accosted in the pulpit by some hot-eyed, leering flasher, and always with an audience. Marvin Zindler was to huckstering what Jehovah's God was to sin, with the exception that Marvin always had cameras there to record the pointing of his vengeful finger. He had a fair penchant for attracting attention. Stories used to float around the city rooms of Houston newspapers about how Marvin would wait 2 or 3 days before serving a warrant until a TV crew was available to immortalize his crime busting, about how Marvin would deluge courthouse reporters with Agatha Christie-style press releases extolling his exploits. About the time the Houston Post on Marvin's hot inside trip bannered the 4-inch headline, Harrelson in Mexico, at the same moment the accused murderer was being arrested in Atlanta. Back when he was the police reporter for a Houston radio station, Zindler would appear just before his on-air signal to relate action-packed on-the-scene accounts that he had just read from the morning papers. Other reporters used to substitute dated papers, and he'd dash in to announce, over the air, "This is Marvin Zindler, on the scene," and launch into a breathless blow-by-blow of last month's liquor store holdups. Zindler even looks the part, which is to say artificial. His nose and chin were metamorphosed long ago to meet superstar specifications, and his head is permanently hidden by a handsome Cary Grant toupee. And his clothes, equally handsome, are custom-tailored to conceal the pads he wears on his shoulders and buttocks to fill out his figure to superstar proportions. It's always been easy, of course, to make fun of Marvin Zindler, as do most of his colleagues in journalism. But strangely enough, it just won't wash. For one thing, he's so absurdly upfront about those wigs and pads and nose jobs of his, and he confesses instantly, cheerfully, to arranging egomania. It's hard to laugh at somebody's closet skeletons when they rattle them at you. And then there's his eyes, as warmly blue and gentle and genuine as any superstar could hope to possess. The only external hint that within that ludicrously handmade body of his, there's a soft nub of sincerity and compassion. Danny, who's sort of a hustler, remembers being arrested by Marvin way back when he was just another deputy in the warrants division. Most of the crooks I know have a lot of respect for Zindler. He was a straight-up cop. After he had busted you, he'd stick around till you were mugged and printed and in the tank, and he'd make sure you had cigarettes before he'd leave. He still shows that same concern in his role as Channel 13's consumer affairs reporter, staying long after work to answer a blizzard of phone calls from 12-year-olds with lost bicycles and dowdy matrons who don't like the gas company. He rationalizes his media mongering by saying most corporations involved in, say, false advertising will just laugh at a $50 fine. But if you show up with a TV camera and give them bad publicity, then they'll shape up. There's a hard truth there. If Marvin's style, a zany blend of P.T. Barnum and Dudley Do-Right, has made him notorious, it's also made him effective. Instead of being just another petty public ombudsman, he's become a kind of electric bounty hunter, striking media terror into the fast-talking hearts of consumer bilkers. That's why it all seemed a little strange when Marvin set out after the chicken ranch. While there may well be lots of people who don't like the place, irate consumers aren't among them. But Marvin says his crusade against the ranch wasn't based on any righteous shock at all the whoring going on down there. "I'm no moralist," he'll tell you. Marvin's targets were bigger than just sin, political corruption, and organized crime. Marvin's story is that he got his hands on a Department of Public Safety, DPS, intelligence report that hadn't been made last year. This report, according to Marvin, says that the chicken ranch, together with another less renowned little whorehouse in Sealy, grosses a conservative minimum of $3 million a year, and that most of this money was going into numbered bank accounts in Mexico by way of lavish payoffs to all manner of corrupt state and local officials. It's these officials, the story goes, who really own the chicken ranch and whose power in Austin allows it to stay open. Then there's the black specter of organized crime, whose ruthless involvement Marvin keeps invoking. Marvin's definition of organized crime, though, is not exactly what you'd first think. It has nothing to do with the mafia, or the syndicate, or Chicago, or New York, or even Houston. It maybe has something to do with the circuit of other country whorehouses through which girls are rotated, but it's hard to say. Marvin's definition of organized crime is pretty vague. Nonetheless, Marvin bought this DPS report at face value, lock, stock, and brothel. He has great faith in the Texas Rangers. When he first saw the report last January, he says he was asked by the Rangers not to do anything until they had had the chance to move in. Marvin agreed. Then, along about May, Marvin got word that the DPS Ranger investigation had been canceled. That's when I really got mad, remembers Marvin. Because it proved to me that somebody from higher up was interfering with the enforcing of the law. That's when Marvin went to work. He recruited as his collaborator Larry Connors, a young TV newsman who is a first-rate investigative reporter and the most hard-ass interviewer this side of Mike Wallace. The Zindler and Connors team went underground to begin their investigation. They sat in the woods outside the ranch, counting and photographing the patrons. Connors, together with the cameraman, but sadly no TV camera, handled the inside work, discovering firsthand that there really was prostitution going on in there. After 3 months of this sort of thing, they were able to prove that, sure enough, there's a whorehouse in LaGrange. That's when they broke the story and ran up against, or into, County Sheriff T.J. Jim Flournoy. Old Jim Flournoy looks like he leapt full-bodied from one of the Bobby Seale's nightmare visions of a county sheriff, a pot-bellied, gun-toting, hulking incarnation of frontier justice. Slow-talking, in keeping with his thought patterns, Big Jim's style of dealing with the world is based largely on threat and is generally successful. His brother Mike, who is the sheriff over in Wharton County, has a reputation for carrying out his threats, but Big Jim's never gone overboard with that sort of thing. Like his predecessors, Big Jim was easily accommodated to the existence of the chicken ranch. Back in 1958, he'd even had a hotline installed to connect the ranch and the sheriff's office, and he's one of the biggest defenders of its operations. "It's never caused no trouble round here," he says. "No fights or dope or nothing. It ain't never got no complaints." It's been a positive boon to law enforcement, if you listen to the sheriff. "Because of the ranch, there's never been no rapes while I've been sheriff," he relates. "Of course, that don't count no nigger rapes," he adds, which is probably fair enough since blacks weren't admitted to the ranch anyway. He goes on to tell you about the $10,000 that Edna contributed to the hospital building fund, her other munificences, the economic benefits to the community, the low rate of venereal disease afforded by having county-inspected hookers on hand. As Larry Connors puts it, he makes that whorehouse sound like a damn nonprofit county recreational facility. Most of Big Jim's arguments are pretty spacious as well. His figures on rapes, VD, pregnancy, and dope, all of which says there are none of, excepting for niggers, are all bogus. And the $10,000 bequest about equals the annual take on the jukebox. As for the local impact, one local shopkeeper easily dismissed that they only got a payroll of a dozen out there. Now how much money you figure a dozen whores gonna spend in this town? All sad but true. For all Big Jim's efforts at rationalizing, the ranch's longevity was built on sentiment rather than cash. And sentiment is a poor defense against either the law or a zealous camera. Once Channel 13 weighed in against the bawdy houses, as they called them, there was no contest. That doesn't mean, however, that Zindler ever proved his vague assertions about corruption and organized crime. He never even proved his contention that the two whorehouses grossed over $3 million a year. Most local ranch watchers think that ludicrously high, and the most commonly accepted figure was about $300,000. The IRS, who never failed to collect the government's portion, never questioned Edna's returns. All that Marvin had to do, really, was haul his cameras out to LaGrange and put on the tube what every local farm boy for 100 miles already knew. Big Jim, who'd probably never before seen the business end of a TV camera, was mercilessly pinned in one of those Connors interviews. He erupted against those goddamn DPS fellers who had been poking around last fall and allowed as how he had called DPS Chief Colonel Wilson Spear to get them off his back. The colonel, said Big Jim, told him to close down the ranch until the elections were over with, so Big Jim obliged. It was the kind of interview that could make you wonder whose side he was really on. After a week of nightly exposés, during which the ranch kept whoring along with all flags flying, Marvin went up to Austin to interview the governor, the attorney general, and Colonel Spear. Confronted simultaneously with prima facie sin and TV cameras, they professed outrage that this could be going on and promised to get to the bottom of things. On Wednesday, the day before he was to go to Austin to answer a summons from the governor, Big Jim capitulated. He just called Edna and told her to shut it down. Marvin promptly left for Jamaica on vacation. Within a week of its shuttering, the ranch is deserted, with only Lily still hanging around to shoo off curious interlopers. Edna is hiding out with her old man in East Texas, and the girls are in Dallas, Houston, Austin, streetwalking. Big Jim is being especially suspicious of strangers, hinting bluntly to the writer from Playboy that he's seen all about all the snoopy journalists he cares to. At Birkelbach's Cafe in Round Top, the hangers-on discuss what to do with Marvin Zindler, should he ever chance to pass through town. A petition circulates in LaGrange to save the ranch, and bumper stickers made their appearance, proclaiming the same thing. Local opinion, as figured by the owner of the local radio station, breaks about even. A few local tycoons begin making plans to buy the ranch and turn it into a restaurant, with private dining rooms in each of the bedrooms. There is indeed little evidence of any sort that the ranch had ended its days. It had always existed, really as a pleasant irrelevance, kind of a collective daydream by a rural people that believed in dreams remnant from a simpler era that had a tolerant niche for such things, along with eccentric uncles and town drunks. Like all the excess baggage from that era, realized daydreams have been burrowed under by the plow of progress. X-rated movies and celluloid sex are all right in the modern age, as is everything that is malleable into legalisms and electricity. But that additional dimension of humanity that the ranch possessed is out of scene, not immoral, just obsolete. Here's a short article from Texas Monthly, May 2016. The Road to the Chicken Ranch. You've heard about it, but how much do you know about one of Texas's most famous ranches? by John Nova Lomax. This weekend, my daughter decided she wanted a wall of her room to be covered in maps. That sent me rummaging through my closet where I had stocked a couple hundred, many of them given to me over the years by my pack rat grandparents. The one you see here is the most mysterious. On the map, which appears to be torn out of a book, the infamous Chicken Ranch is as prominently marked as anything else. Description of photograph above. The photograph is a close-up of a map in which the town of LaGrange is center focus. The word LaGrange appears below, and you can below a what looks like a city grid of streets, and the word Chicken Ranch appears right above and to the right of the word LaGrange, being the Chicken Ranch supposedly was southeast of LaGrange, Texas. The map also features the area's highways, including 71, 159, 2145, and so forth. Back to main text. Flip it over and here's what it says. Here it is, blue bonneting, beer drinking, and road rallying time again. As with last year, you should endeavor to find your way to Stone Tree by driving on rural roads only. Consider these routes. There follows four different routes out of Houston to Round Top, where apparently this Stone Tree was located. If you get mixed up, stop anywhere and ask directions. We are advised as pre-GPS travelers. We are also given a few quaint travel hints. Driving time at 55 miles per hour and no stopovers will be a little more than 2 hours. Unless you get excellent mileage, you'll probably need to top up your tank along the way somewhere to get back to Houston. Gas has been readily available in the past. Those of the beer-drinking, blue-bonneting, road-rallying persuasion are also advised to stop at Winedale Stagecoach Inn, today the centerpiece of the UT-affiliated Winedale Historical Complex. It's part of the Dolph Briscoe Center for American History, which in turn takes its name from the man who officially shut down the Chicken Ranch. Other hints. Antiquing in Round Top and visiting that town's general store proprietor, Bet Shat, fishing for bass and catfish in the creeks and lakes, a malty pit stop in New Ulm's apparently long-gone parlor beer garden, and, of course, the Chicken Ranch. For you history buffs, a pilgrimage to the Chicken Ranch, although closed, would be something for you to tell your grandchildren about. I don't know about that. Call me a prude, but I was not ready to tell my 11-year-old daughter about the Chicken Ranch just yet, and it seemed odd to imagine the day when I might tell her children all about the best little whorehouse in Texas. But it did set me to thinking. I knew of the musical and the movie, and I knew the song quite well. As a kid, when my dad used to crank it up on the car radio, I imagined that Billy Gibbons was an actual monster singing. And later came to know Houston reporter Marvin Zindler's role in bringing the place to its end. But how much did I really know about the Chicken Ranch, America's most famous bordello? Not much, as it happens. The history. Though there were bordellos in LaGrange as early as 1844, the Chicken Ranch did not find its home until early in the 20th century and did not take its infamous name until the Great Depression. According to the Handbook of Texas, a woman going by Jesse Williams, though born Faye Stewart, bought the Chicken Ranch property just outside of town and just ahead of a massive vice sweep on LaGrange's red light district in 1915. Williams always cultivated a good relationship with the town's power structure. She donated to worthy causes, sent care packages to soldiers in France during World War I, and assisted Fayette County Sheriff Will Loyson with his investigations. Miss Jessie's girls were under strict orders to report any pillow talk of felonious activity to her, which she would in turn report to Loyson, who visited the cat house nightly, the better to keep his eyes on Fayette County's underworld, such as it was. As the Depression deepened, many of Miss Jessie's clients could no longer pay cash, so she began to accept barter, which often came in the form of chickens. one chicken for one screw became the house's poultry standard. And so was born the chicken ranch. Miss Jessie became a small-scale poultry tycoon. In 1952, Miss Jessie hired Edna Milton, the young woman who was to succeed her. The chicken ranch's final madam had been born into dire poverty in Oklahoma in 1928, the eighth of 11 children, and just in time for the Depression and the Dust Bowl. She dropped out of school in third or fourth grade and was forced into an unwanted marriage at 16. That marriage produced a child who died shortly after birth. The marriage foundered, and by the time she was 23, Milton was a prostitute working for Miss Jessie. By that time, Miss Jessie was suffering from arthritis, no longer able to wield the iron cudgel she used to keep rowdy patrons in line with as much authority, nor possessing the mental energy to run the house as efficiently. She saw a spark in Milton, savvy in spite of her lack of schooling. Miss Jessie handed off more and more of the running of the place to her, and by the time Miss Jessie passed away at 80 in 1961, Milton had completed her training program. She bought the place from Miss Jessie's heirs for $30,000 and became Miss Edna. Miss Edna picked up right where Miss Jessie left off. She cultivated the same working relationship with Sheriff T.J. Flournoy that Miss Jessie had with his predecessor. She donated to many of the same causes Miss Jessie had helped nurture. She installed air conditioning and added a dining room. At its peak in the 1960s, there were 16 girls working in as many bedrooms. Drinking was not allowed, but Miss Edna would sell you a Coke for the pricely sum of $1 or a pack of Luckies for 75 cents. Off-duty cops directed traffic in the parking lot. Much of the clientele came from nearby military bases and Texas A&M, where, according to legend, a chicken ranch trip was part of freshman initiation. Miss Edna charged her customers $15 for 15 minutes, and each of her workers was expected to have between 5 and 20 customers a day. Miss Edna took 3/4 of the cut, leaving many of the women to take home about $300 a week, which was a decent sum in those days. Given its place in the classic rock canon and the multi-generational ubiquity in pop culture, ZZ Top's LaGrange, their tribute to Texas's infamous Bordello, is not just their signature tune, but probably the most recognized rock and roll song ever to emerge from Texas. Some believe the song inadvertently helped bring about the downfall of the Chicken Ranch, but based on the band's telling, it seems they had their own connection to it. Here's ZZ Top's bassist, Dusty Hill, speaking as only Dusty can, to Spin Magazine in 1985. I was there when I was 13. A lot of boys in Texas, when it's time to be a guy, went there and had it done. Fathers took their sons there. You couldn't cuss in there. You couldn't drink. I had an air of respectability. Miss Edna wouldn't stand for no bullshit. That's the woman that ran the place. And you know, she didn't look like Dolly Parton either. I'll tell you, she was a mean-looking woman. But oil field workers and senators would both be there. The place had been open for over 100 years, and this asshole decides he's going to do an expose and close it. And he stirred up so much shit that it had to close. LaGrange is a little bitty town, and little towns in Texas are real conservative. But they fought against it. They didn't want it closed, because it was like a landmark. It was on a little ranch outside of town, the Chicken Ranch. Anyway, we wrote this song and put it out, and it was maybe 3 months before they closed it. It pissed me off. It was a whorehouse, but anything that lasts 100 years, there's got to be a reason. What happened to it? Area native Jamie Lynn Blash, author of an upcoming history of the Chicken Ranch, recently toured the grounds. Not much is left other than the tumble-down ruins of the office and a few of the bedrooms in a pasture studded with prickly pear. The Chicken Ranch's common area left the premises long ago. In 1977, businessman Bill Fair III bought the parlor and its furnishings and trucked it to Big D's Greenville Avenue, where he joined it to an existing building and repurposed it as a discotheque bar restaurant with a chicken heavy menu, and none other than Miss Edna herself serving as hostess. The Dallas Chicken Ranch also featured bar stools mounted on plastic bear female legs and peddled souvenirs such as T-shirts with the slogan, "I had a ball at the Chicken Ranch." Miss Edna cared not a whit about her outing as Texas's most famous ex-madam. By that point, she noted her parents were dead. "I don't care what the rest of the world thinks of me." LaGrange Journal owner and editor Lester Zapalek was amused when he heard of the ranch's relocation and repurposing. "That's kind of a cute idea," he told the San Antonio Express News. "Some of those people in Dallas are going to be embarrassed when they see their names or initials on those walls unless they are going to paint over them." They didn't. Perhaps that prospect chilled the hearts of customers even more than the stated reason for the restaurant's failure in January 1978. A literal lack of warmth. Fair apparently did not install adequate heating in the Greenville structure. "Nobody wants to sit around in a place that's 50 degrees," he said. In June 1978, the furnishings were auctioned off. Noted Seguin Gazette Enterprise columnist Ben Micas, at a public auction to dispose of the Chicken Ranch's furnishings, one gentleman attending the festivities was heard to wonder out loud how the Chicken Ranch could survive two world wars and one depression near the country town of LaGrange and manage to turn a profit of up to $1.5 million a year and then go bankrupt in Dallas in less than 3 months. The gentleman's companion, no doubt an astute disciple of human nature, was quick to point out that if there's a product a man really wants, he doesn't mind driving a few extra miles to get it. Miss Edna went on to open a Chicken Ranch bar on Dallas's Lemon Avenue, and after that too swiftly failed, she moved to Gladewater and got married. At some point around that time, she sold her story to Larry L. King, whose Playboy article spawned the Broadway hit musical and later the Dolly Parton and Burt Reynolds film that, unlike the musical, Miss Edna openly hated. After the death of her husband, Miss Edna remarried a man named Chadwell and quietly lived out the rest of her days in Phoenix, where she died 4 years ago. And finally, I'm going to read this short article regarding her death. Texas Monthly, The Culture: Last Madam at the LaGrange Chicken Ranch Dead at 84. Edna Milton Chadwell was the madam running the famous brothel when authorities shut it down in 1973. By Sonia Smith, published February 2012. 28 years, 6 months, and 24 days after authorities swooped in and shuttered the LaGrange Chicken Ranch, the legendary brothel's last madam has drawn her final breath. Edna Milton Chadwell died on February 25th at the age of 84 after being injured in a car wreck, her nephew told the Houston Chronicle. Chadwell began working at the brothel in 1952 and bought it 9 years later for $30,000 upon the death of the brothel's founder, Miss Jessie, Tony Fremantle wrote for the Chronicle. Chadwell's nephew, Robert Kleffman, said that while his Oklahoma-born aunt did not speak of her brothel-owning past, she did maintain a thorough dislike for investigative television reporter Marvin Zindler, whose reporting forced authorities to crack down on the brothel. After the brothel closed, Chadwell left LaGrange for Gladewater in northeast Texas, where she married. She moved to Phoenix after remarrying, where she remained until her death. From her nephew's telling, the last few years of her life seemed pretty bleak. She stayed in her house and watched TV and smoked 2 cartons of cigarettes a week, Kleffman said. She just existed that last 10 years. She just existed. Al Reinert penned the definitive piece on the Chicken Ranch, the oldest continually operating non-floating whorehouse in the United States, in the October 1973 issue of Texas Monthly. The story of the Chicken Ranch was eventually turned into a stage production and a movie, The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, which starred Burt Reynolds and Dolly Parton.
It's just a Billy Sweatin' old time country place. Nothing too high tone. Just lots of good wheel and maybe one small thrill, but there's nothing dirty going on.
You're watching Channel 13, KTRK TV, Houston. Number one in Texas. 13, Eyewitness News. With Dave Ward, Bob Allen has sports, weather with Ed Rendon, and Action 13's Marvin Zindler. Now, 13, Eyewitness News.
Action 13's Marvin Zindler is on the job.
Either did the best of things or the worst of things when I prevailed on the governor to close two boarding houses last July. A lot of former prospective patrons thought I had some ulterior motive in picking on the old chicken ranch at LaGrange and the newer model at Sealy. To them, I was some sort of ogre, a killjoy. Well, I wasn't out to spoil anybody's fun or close their playpen just to improve the moral climate of this part of Texas. My colleague Larry Connors and I got into the act only after a couple of frustrated lawmen found their bosses in Austin wouldn't pay any attention to their suspicions that there were possible links to organized crime and payoffs involved. Larry and a photographer got all the evidence we needed in one night of surveillance and inside investigation. The next day, Larry returned in the daylight to LaGrange and talked to a reluctant Edna Milton and asked her what kind of business she was running.
I have a boarding house here.
Is that all it is?
It's enough.
You're not operating a house of prostitution?
Whether I am or not doesn't come under the heading of your business.
Governor Briscoe, of course, had no choice but to shut down LaGrange and Lesser Light Sealy, but it was and still is the responsibility of local law enforcement officials to keep such places shuttered. Fayette County Sheriff T.J. Flannoy had a curious comment when asked if he had ever shut down the chicken ranch.
Last year, I understand that the Texas Rangers did give you a call, and I think they even came down and talked to you about it and asked you to close down, and you did close down for a while.
When they come down to me, I said, well, I'll go talk to Colonel Spear, and I did. And the Colonel told me, it was just before the election, and he told me to close them down a while and take a little vacation, and I did.
When it got down to it, Flannoy and his counterpart in Austin County did close both LaGrange and Sealy the easy way. They just called the madams and told them to send their girls packing. The Chicken Ranch story got big play around the state, nation, and world. The Paris edition of the Herald Tribune gave it a lot of attention. Texas Monthly did a cover story, and the Rice University Band used it as a theme for two football halftime performances. When it was all over, the local LaGrange newspaper, which had never in 100 years acknowledged that the Chicken Ranch existed, carried an editorial acknowledging that maybe it was a good thing for the town to have the playpen shut down. But at year's end, reports persist that LaGrange is once again in operation. There are denials from all sides, and all sides are on notice that we won't be looking the other way in the new year. Not as long as my name is Marvin Zindler, Eyewitness News.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear recording library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National Magazine of Texas.
2 miles until we get to heaven.
2 miles until our plans are laid.
2 miles until we get to the chicken ranch.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Senior Notes, followed by the History Book Hour at 9. On this week's Texas Monthly Archives, we're reading articles featuring the world-famous Chicken Ranch. So we're following in that same theme with our audio-described movie, Saturday Night.
It wasn't always easy in them days to come up with hard cash.
Well, you just keep that in the bag and I'll take it out back as soon as we're finished.
So the girls begin accepting poultry in trade, and that's how the place got its name. The Chicken Ranch.
Just lots of thrill and maybe one small thrill, but there's nothing dirty going on.
Mammy.
I've loved you since I was 16 years old. And as much as I'd love for it to work, I know deep down in my heart it ain't never going to be.
And
Audio-described musical, The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Yeehaw! Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 84 and clear. Tonight, a few showers with a low in the low 70s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
Hi folks, I'm Jeff Bressler, turning on the lights of the Make-Believe Ballroom and welcoming you into my crystal studio for another program of the great hits of the 1930s and 1940s. I'm hosting the show to keep the music and traditions of past hosts, Martin Block, Al Jarvis, William B. Williams, and the legendary Steve Allen alive. Whether you're one of my longtime listeners or a new listener on public broadcasting or community radio stations across the U.S. as well as in the U.K., grab your dance ticket, it's free, and let's reminisce. Hello world and from coast to coast on public university and community radio stations, welcome, welcome, welcome to the Make-Believe Ballroom, and thanks for joining me this hour as I share some wonderful swing jazz and big band music, and many of the stories behind the records and the personalities who recorded them. I hope you're all doing well today. On this edition of the Ballroom, I want to take a look at some band leaders who were popular during the era, but have not really stood the test of time and are barely remembered or played today. So to those whose music I'm about to play, I pay tribute to you and hope to let others hear your wonderful work. Why don't we get right underway and let's get started with Barney Rapp. Barney was born in New Haven, Connecticut, but found his way to the Midwest where he lived in Cleveland before settling in Cincinnati and remaining there for the rest of his life. His regional band was one of the most popular in the Midwest. Before I go on, I just forgot to mention that Barney was a drummer. In Cincinnati, Barney decided to open a nightclub where he performed with his orchestra and also did radio remotes from the location. I think a lot of great band leaders didn't have the opportunity to get great name recognition. Simply due to the fact that they rarely left their home turf, like Barney, except to record. Didn't do a lot of appearances around the country. Now, even though Rapp was calling the shots from Cincinnati, he had two great vocal finds. Barney helped to launch the career of Doris Day, who started as a vocalist in his band when she was only 14 years old. Rapp felt that Doris Kappelhoff, which was Doris Day's given name, was too long for Marquise, and Barney admired the rendition of a song that she sang day after day. Hence, he changed the name to Doris Day, which Doris appreciated and obviously used for the rest of her life. Rapp also recommended the Clooney sisters, Rosemary and Betty, to bandleader Tony Pastor. After hearing them sing on the radio in Cincinnati when they were teenagers back in 1947. A featured singer with Rapp's band was Ruby Wright, and Barney and Ruby later got married. And you will now hear Ruby, along with Barney Rapp and his New Englanders, 52nd Street, recorded in 1937.
Every magazine gives a mention to a street that's really quite the same. Once you visit there, you'll adore it. Once you visit there, you'll be for it. Just you listen to my story about the street I'm swinging. It was just a normal street till it got that all-time beat. Now it's the place where the swing can be, 52nd Street. It's an endless whoa, where the torrid trumpet blows. It's quite the thing when you're feeling low, 52nd Street. Debutantes who like the rhythm rockin', make it their rendezvous. Though their swing is absolutely shocking, the mamas ain't blue, 'cause the mamas swing too. It's a world that's set apart. It's where swinging got its start. It's like the beat of a swinging heart. Two blocks from 50, you'll find the lifty 52nd Street. Listen to those swing harmonics coming from that well-known onyx.
If the swing you feel you're ready, you should meet Leon and Eddie. Travel to the Cali and it, when they swing plenty.
Wall Street swings those corporations, but 52nd Street has syncopation.
I'm Jeff Bressler, and you're listening to the Make Believe Ballroom. I can be reached, as always, at jeff@makebelieveballroomradio.com, jeff@makebelieveballroomradio.com. And we are learning about and listening to today some band leaders who were popular during the big band era, but have, for the most part, been forgotten. Now, here's another band leader who didn't really have tremendous exposure to the public in terms of making appearances around the country. So he sort of stayed off the radar because of the type of work he did. Henry King was a pianist. As a matter of fact, he started as a classical pianist, but Henry quickly learned that classical did not equate to bread on the table. So he went the orchestra route, achieving significant success as a recording artist, long-term hotel band leader, and as a leader of radio orchestras. If you're an old-time radio fan, like I am, you might recognize his name. Henry was the orchestra leader on the Burns and Allen radio program, and meaning George and Gracie, did an episode about Henry's wedding in 1937. King eventually left Burns and Allen to do an extended residency at the Palmer House in Chicago. You're a Builder Upper, recorded in New York on Columbia, August the 14th, 1934, with a vocal by Joseph Suddy.